This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the things that has to be done is to agree on the science. We have to agree what the problem is and how fast this melt is going to take over.
Today on Sea Change Radio, we begin a two-part series on the Arctic. If you're looking for present-day observable impacts of global warming, head north, where the melting of the polar ice cap has opened up oil reserves, shipping lanes, and many other opportunities for trade and transport. If you're looking for a preview of the unanticipated consequences of climate change, including new sorts of geopolitical conflict over territory and commerce, the Arctic is also a good place to watch that unfold. My guest today is author David Fairhall, whose book Cold Front, Conflict Ahead in Arctic Waters, explores these very issues. We talk about the environmental, economic, and political ramifications of a new, thawed Arctic, and discuss whether the last best hope for ecological preservation in the Arctic lies in the hands of the scientific community. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Fairhall. His new book is Cold Front, Conflict Ahead in Arctic Waters. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be with you.
First, tell us, what's the reality right now in the Arctic? How visible to the naked eye, to somebody who's been up there several times, are these shifts in water levels and temperature?
Well, at the moment, superficially, you would see a little sign of it, because it's a very cold, dark, frozen place. looking at it across the seasons, the changes have been quite dramatic. Passages across, that we think of historically, the Northwest Passage across the Canadian archipelago, the Northeast Passage across Siberia. Those have been waters that have rarely been open, and very rarely open simultaneously, the two passages, northeast and northwest. But we've seen that in recent years, and we've seen not just a dramatic melting of the ice during the summer months, particularly in 2007, 4 years ago, but a very steady trend towards melting in the summer months. Over the last 30 years, the amount of ice left in the summer across the Arctic Ocean has decreased by about a third. It's going down about 1% a year. It's steadily drifting away, and we're expecting, and when I say we, I'm talking of those who are studying it in detail all the time, the meteorologists, the scientists in various ways, they're expecting that by about 2040, which may be a long time ahead in terms of individuals, but in terms of big industrial processes and social changes and scientific changes is only a very short time. By about 2040, we may see the whole of the Arctic Ocean free from ice for maybe several weeks, maybe several months even, which means, of course, that all sorts of activities will become much easier, and that in particular, and this is what's prompted my interest to write this book, shipping will be able to cross from the Atlantic to the Pacific by going straight across the North Pole.
Yes, and you were the Guardian's defense correspondent throughout much of the Cold War.
I was indeed.
And this is a new sort of Cold War on the horizon. You see not just a traditional military conflict, but a whole host of conflict ahead in the region. Can you expand on that for us?
Yes. I don't want to sound alarmist about it. I'm not alarmist about it, because as it happens, the maritime world has a long tradition of cooperation internationally, which is a very good omen for how they'll deal with disputes that almost inevitably are going to arise as the Arctic Ocean opens up. But the fact is that vast resources of oil and gas and rare minerals, nickel, palladium, zinc, gold even, vast resources are going to be more readily available. Inevitably, there will be economic and, in a derivative way, political competition to get at this stuff. And there are going to be disputes. And at the moment, for example, no one knows who owns the North Pole in the sense of who has the legal right under international law to dig beneath the seabed of the North Pole to find what's there. Now, as it happens, we know that not much that we're interested is there. But if you then go round the periphery of the Arctic Ocean, you find vast resources, something like 20-25% of the world's undiscovered reserves of gas and oil are lying off the shores of the Arctic Ocean.
And in addition to fishing and...
Well, absolutely, yes. Fishing is another good example of things that have got to be resolved. In some ways, the fish will tend to move further. In some areas, the fish will tend to move further forward. A lot more will be accessible. And there will be disputes, as there always are with fishing, as to who has the right to catch what. And when you've decided that technically, you know, country X has the right, say we're talking about Russia and Norway, up in the Barents Sea, okay, they decide that they're going to share the catch. But then somehow or other, there's a dispute about who has accurately declared what in terms of catching, and it becomes a dispute. I was involved as a young conscript in the what we called the Cod Wars between Britain and Iceland, which ended in heavy defeat for Britain when the Icelanders claimed all the fish around their coastal waters. But I mean that we came to blows over that with Icelandic Coast Guard boats tearing around, cutting the wires of the British trawlers and British warships trying to intervene. It was, you know, an ugly business. And the Russian Navy is already beginning to flex its muscles in defense of what it regards as its strategic economic assets in the Arctic.
And as these passageways begin to expand, the trouble will inevitably expand along with it, and the confusion, I imagine.
That's right. I mean, take two very staunch allies who both have important access to the Arctic, your own country, the United States, and Canada. Now, you can't imagine, one would think, that you know, two such staunch allies would be arguing about anything fundamental, but that's not the case. The Canadians, having closed their archipelago, the Northwest Passage, that we call it in Europe, because it's northwest from us if you're heading out to cross the world, they have enclosed that archipelago and declared that it is internal waters in terms of international law. That means that nobody else has any right of access or right of passage through those waters. The United States says that's not the case. These are international waters. We're free to go wherever we like, to send our submarines through there, send our aircraft carriers, to send our icebreakers, our fishing vessels, whatever it may be. The Canadians are turning to a United Nations convention to back their case. The United States, for domestic political reasons, has never ratified that particular convention, so it can't turn to international law to back its case. But here's a fundamental dispute as to whether a U.S. warship, if you like, has the right of innocent passage across the Canadian archipelago. The Pentagon would say absolutely. The Canadian government would and does say, not on your life. This is internal waters. We have total control over them.
Cold feeling. You're just like ice around my heart. I've got a cold, cold feeling, yeah, yeah. You're just like ice around my heart.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author David Fairhall. His latest book is Cold Front, Conflict Ahead in Arctic Waters. David, when we look at the conflicts and potential conflicts in the region, it seems apparent that most of them are going to be over resources, both political and commerce related. But can science be a way to bring these different countries together in the name of climate science, as opposed to just scientists who are looking to exploit the region further in terms of oil and gas exploration?
Well, I very, very much hope that what you're suggesting is true, because when you turn to the threats to our climate that are represented by the melting Arctic, then we're all in this together. There's no question about that. One would hope that we could all agree on the extent of the problem and what needs to be done to resist these various processes. Now, we know that that's not that's easier said than done. But take something like the effects on weather. As the Arctic melts, so the weather is going to become more unstable. The Arctic is warming, and I don't think this would be in dispute even amongst the climate change skeptics. The Arctic is warming almost twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and the weather is going to become more unstable. And one of the things that could happen, I'm now speaking as a European sitting on the eastern side of the North Atlantic, being warmed by a warm current we call the Gulf Stream that runs up from the Caribbean and, in fact, ultimately runs deep into the Arctic Ocean. It could well be that that current will be disturbed by what's going on in the Arctic Ocean, and we shall suddenly become a couple of degrees colder in Western Europe. Now, a couple of degrees may not sound very much, but in fact, in fundamental climatic terms, it's a very fundamental change. And then if you look further beyond that, you may begin to unlock the vast quantities of methane that are frozen and embedded in the shores of the Arctic Ocean and the tundra. Now the energy industries will say, oh, maybe that'll be yet another resource we can tap into, these frozen methane hydrates, and we can get some energy out of it. It's also the case that if that release is uncontrollable, as it could well be if the global warming goes at the pace that many fear it will, that will produce a runaway climatic change, which will be extremely dangerous. So this is being studied by all the nations involved, and as you point out, there's no need for them to get involved in who owns what particular resource. They're concerned to understand what's going on in the Arctic, and at the moment they don't fully understand it. They're just watching and waiting and hoping gradually to get a grip on the science. But that's something that can and I should be done on a fully cooperative basis.
It seems cooperation will be the key to trying to solve these problems up there.
That's right. No, the thing I'm trying to be reassuring about is that there are precedents, there are good omens up there for cooperation, scientific, economic, political. For example, the Russians and the Norwegians have recently signed an agreement to divide up access to the Barents Sea, which is immediately north of Norway and of the northwest corners of the of Russia. So that's a good omen. And if you were to compare the you know, the potential for conflict up in the Arctic, set aside the fact that I've mentioned it in the title of my book, with somewhere like the Middle East, there's just no comparison. You know, the intensity of conflicts and disputes and so on across the Middle East is so much greater. So we're not in that the same league as we are in Iran or Syria or Tunisia or Libya or wherever. We have got a good basis of international collaboration, but one of the things that has to be done is to agree on the science. We have to agree what the problem is and how fast this melt is going to take over.
And can you give us some examples of the science community giving you hope that things are progressing better than some people fear?
Yes, I think one hopeful sign, for example, is that the U.S. Navy is now an ally of the sciences, is now helping science by releasing all the data that it's accumulated over many decades of secret transits under the Arctic ice cap. That's a good sign. The navies are collaborating. The Coast Guard organizations that run the icebreakers up there, they're collaborating. For example, take a specific problem, the problem of oil pollution, which is one of the really serious dangers of economic exploitation up there, the prospect of a massive oil leak, either from a well or from a ship, being trapped under the ice and gradually migrating across the Arctic Ocean, no one knowing really where it is until it turns up on the other side. That sort of danger is being tackled insofar as the resources are available by countries like Sweden, Russia, Norway. They hold multinational emergency exercises. They practice, you know, tackling an oil spill that might happen somewhere else, Murmansk, where they have a big storage tanker which supplies tankers shipping the oil out into the rest of the world. They have every year they have a big emergency exercise, which is done on a collaborative international basis. So, you know, I'll take another example: the nuclear pollution, which has been left behind by the Russian activities up there. The United States and Norway and Britain, in a small way, have been supporting the Russians in trying to clean up the damage left behind. So, you know, there is a fund of goodwill. There is the makings of an international organization that could tackle some of the problems as the area opens up. But just to go back briefly to what you said right at the beginning of this, of your, you know, question a moment ago, we mustn't forget that when we say the Arctic will be open in the summer, that for a large part of the year, it will still not be remotely open. It will be covered in ice. It will be dark. It will be very cold. It will be very stormy. It will be an awful place.
David, would it be fair to say that the greatest threat to the region are from companies and corporations that have short-term gains as their MO, as opposed to a long-arching view of the region? And we could maybe see more of a battle between rogue corporations and the international community?
Yes, I think that's fundamentally true. The requirement here is for long-term thinking. For example, take Greenland. Greenland is going to go through the whole cycle that we've seen elsewhere in the Arctic as they discover, or not so much discover, but get access to reserves of oil, gas, and very valuable minerals. And the community there, the indigenous community, which has been run from Copenhagen by the Danes for a long while now, is flexing its muscles. It is it's looking for complete independence, and it's looking to control this economic development in a sensible, civilized way. Well, that takes long-term thinking, and one of the sadnesses when you look at the situation is that most political systems don't work on the long term. They don't want to look too far ahead. The energy companies don't want to look ahead to a new world where their products do more harm than good, perhaps, in some cases. They just want to exploit the immediate opportunities. And if we're going to make the best of this situation, then we need to think long term. I'm afraid that, I mean, certainly my government, which is re-elected every 4 years or so in the UK, long-term thinking of that kind is extremely difficult. I imagine it's the same in the United States, but my goodness, it will be needed if we're going to sort out the problems that arise as the Arctic melts.
Sea Change Radio is sponsored by Redwood Hill Farm, a family-owned and operated award-winning humane certified goat dairy farm and organic creamery located in Sonoma County, California. Go to redwoodhill.com to learn more about Redwood Hill Farm's extensive line of natural goat milk dairy products. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author David Fairhall. His latest book is Cold Front, Conflict Ahead in Arctic Waters. David, you mentioned that the summertime may be much freer of ice, and so it would allow more shipping and transportation. Are companies already adapting to this new reality where they're going seasonally a different route to exploit these newfound shipping lanes?
Yes, they are gradually beginning to adapt. You've got the regular traffic that's always been there, even if they had to smash their way through the ice with an icebreaker, to supply very small communities up in the far north, military communities, oil drilling communities, indigenous Inuit or Samoyed communities, which are the inheritors of the old Eskimo traditions. And in the case of Russia, of course, the artificially created communities that were run by forced labor under the communist system. But there's always been the need for vessels to transit the northeast, northwest passages and so on, to supply these communities. Now there is a burst of activity to exploit offshore gas and oil. And that's producing quite a lot of traffic, particularly in the Barents Sea, with ice-strengthened tankers shuttling back and forth. And you've got quite a lot of scientific activity up there, studying the way the ice is melting and what's happening beneath it in terms of the ocean currents. You also got a lot of curious tourists in cruise liners who are wandering up from the Caribbean to have a look at the icebergs breaking off from the Greenland ice cap to try and catch a sight of a polar bear with their binoculars and so on. You've got that traffic, quite extensive. And you've got a small amount, and this is the most fascinating in many ways, a small amount of transit traffic of ships, usually on quite specialist voyages, running perhaps a load of heavy equipment up to a drilling rig somewhere in Siberia, which is actually transiting the whole of the Arctic Ocean. Now, that's been building up very slowly, and that will continue to be a very slow process because people don't invest tens of millions of pounds in ships unless they know there's a solid, reliable use for them. In other words, they're waiting for predictable conditions in the Arctic before they commit themselves to taking that shortcut, as opposed to going through Panama or the Suez. That'll build up very slowly, I think. It will not be suddenly a new world in which every tanker or every container ship, say, every container ship leaving my country, Felixstowe in the North Sea, suddenly turns north as it goes out of the harbour and heads across the Arctic instead of turning south, which they do at the moment, to go through the Suez Canal. The distances that the mileage that can be saved by going across the Arctic is very extensive in some cases. It can be measured in thousands of miles. For example, from Rotterdam to Yokohama in Japan, you save about 4,000 miles by going across the Arctic Ocean. You save about 2,000 miles to going to Shanghai. That's
a lot of oil and gas saved, but...
That's a hell of a lot of oil and gas. Absolutely. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars per trip. Per trip, absolutely.
But it's kind of a conundrum because we're also putting these enormous boats more and more sailing and going right through some of the most sensitive natural resources in the world.
That's right. You know, it's all part of the bigger picture if you dig deep enough.
Can you draw a contrast with what's just a quick thumbnail sketch of some of the issues that are on the other side of the planet, in the Antarctic?
Oh, right. Well, the Antarctic is very different, of course, physically, because it's a landmass surrounded by icy water, whereas the North Polar region is a great deep oceanic basin surrounded by land. And that fundamentally changes the situation. But I think the important thing in the context of your question is that we have an Antarctic Treaty which already governs and inhibits dangerous exploitation of resources down in the Antarctic. So we're starting from a different situation, and we haven't got a row of big, powerful states glowering at each other across the Antarctic continent as we have across the Arctic Ocean. I'm talking to Russia, the United States, Canada, Norway, and Denmark. That's not replicated in the Antarctic.
And how did that Antarctic Treaty get in place, and can that model be replicated from an Antipodean view?
Yeah, I think it got itself into place because essentially there was no immediate profit to be made from any resources that may or may not be hidden down in the Antarctic. I mean, for example, now Britain is just beginning to get into renewed conflict with the Argentinians over the Falklands because there's a possibility of oil down there. But that was not an original problem, and what was going on down there was in the hands of a very small communities within a very small number of nations, and they managed to sort the thing out and agree that they wouldn't despoil that continent, that they would hold back and be very careful about what they did down there. But up in the Arctic, the Arctic nations have themselves so far said that they don't see the need for an Arctic treaty that replicates what happened in the South Polar region. And they would like to rely instead on the UN conventions that exist to determine who controls what and who has the right of access to this and which ship can go where. It's essentially based on one big convention, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea of 1982. So they're putting their faith in that as the legal framework, as opposed to a single treaty.
Author David Fairhall, his new book is Cold Front. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much indeed. Sway the future to the
past and find what will endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy McGriff, Albert Collins, and Widespread Panic. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.